Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 4:59 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today is Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And of course, today is August 11th. So I thought we'd kick off with the 30-year TIP yield. So Treasury and inflation-protected securities are now up to, well, knocking on the door of 2% in terms of a real yield. And that's a significant hurdle over which every other asset class has to jump in order to be competitive. So we've had a massive reversal where we've had the real yield at negative 50 basis points. Now it's up to 2%. So 250 basis points to the upside in the space of little more than a year and a half. So that's a really significant event. Now, of course, we had the negative real yield environment because people were worried more about deflation and were happy to pick up the yields from the TIPS markets back in 2019 and 20. And then, of course, now we're starting to think more about the sustainability of US debt. And this is problematic because the 30-year yield auction yesterday wasn't very well received. So we have the modern-day equivalent of the bond vigilantes, and they are demanding higher yields, and they're getting them. So the 10-year yield now is up to 4.15%. That was an upside key day reversal yesterday from the 4% level, and it followed through on the upside in here today. So that suggests that we're going to see higher yields before we see lower yields. And I'm willing to hold on to my long position in the TLT because I do think that it is more likely than not we're going to get a reversionary rally at some stage, but that's going to be accompanied by a recession. And the recession does not look imminent, but it is inevitable. Now, when we look at the long-term chart of the total return on Treasury futures, well, any semblance of long-term trend consistency has been broken. We can go all the way back to the beginning of the series in 1982, and there had never been an occasion when the total return index sustained a move below the 1,000-day moving average, and now it's doing it. And it has been holding this move below the 1,000-day moving average since early 2022. So this is a profound change. It suggests that the uptrend in bond prices is over, and it's really only now a question of how much chop do we get. But it's not simply about inflation any longer, and this is the big question. It's about the sustainability of the government debt. Now, when I was looking at the possibility of interest rate hikes a year and a half ago, in January of 2022, I was leery and doubtful that they were going to be able to raise rates as aggressively as they did do. And the reason for that is because of the sustainability of the debt. And this is now starting to become a major factor. So unfortunately, I was a year and 10 and what is it, 8 months early in that conclusion, but now it's starting to push up yields. And of course, politicians aren't really in any particular mood to do anything about it right now. This chart, courtesy of the Greed & Feed report, or excuse me, Greed and Fear report by Chris Wood, is I think particularly instructive because we get it going back to 1994. Back then, the percentage of money relative to GDP that was being spent on interest expense was in excess of 17%, but now we're up to 14%. Of course, the big difference is the volume of debt, and this is at, and we are still only at yields of 4%. So let's just consider what happens if yields were to go to where they were in 1995, and relative to the volume of debt outstanding, then the interest expense on that debt would be significantly higher than it was back in 95. This is a very profound breakout. And this is one of the primary reasons why bond yields are still moving higher. So We're in a rather difficult scenario here because, on the one hand, you have the Federal Reserve, where they are attempting to combat inflation, and inflationary pressures are moderating. And in here this week, CPI did not surprise on the upside. So, when we then think about, well, what is going on right now? Well, today we had PPI numbers, and again, there was nothing particularly worrisome. Now, final demand PPI on a month-over-month basis was a bit higher than expected, and on a year-over-year basis, slightly higher than expected. But I don't think that's the real reason why we've had weakness in the stock market. I think it is much more because investors are now starting to think about, well, what's going to happen here? When are they going to start raising taxes? When are some of the when are we going to see in real demand for cutting back on expenses? So this is what is pushing up bond yields. This is basically what I was worried about back in January of 2022. Of course, when I realized that I was wrong and that they were going to be able to raise interest rates, the first thing I did was I went out and started shorting the market. And I'm short again right now. And the NASDAQ is rolling over. And we've had it rally, really, this was a face ripping advance from the lows in October up to the peak, test the peaks around the 16,000 level. Now it's starting to come back down. We're in the dog days of summer. Seasonally, this is one of the least attractive times of the year to buy stocks. We're more likely to have a fair amount of unwinding of overbought conditions. And as we then think about, well, what's next? Well, a lot of the companies that are in the NASDAQ, and particularly those that have been leading the charge, and it is the very large companies have been doing that. The Fangman companies, I'm still using the eight companies, even though it's now regarded as a seven company basket, that really surged higher. So those eight companies, relative to the entire market, they jumped from a market cap. Or excuse me, a percentage of market cap of about 16% up to 24%. In other words, they went up 50% faster than the entire market from the beginning of this year. And now that is starting to roll over. So there's clearly the potential here that we are going to move into a less benign environment for those very large companies. But because they represent such a large percentage of the market cap of just about all the main indices, then there's going to be a bit of knock-on effect as well in there. Now, we should just, I've been looking at lots of different charts here, and I think that some of these give us an idea of, how we should be framing the perspective over the longer term. So I thought this was a particularly interesting one. It's foreign holdings of US dollars, and as a percentage of the total. So it's about 59% right now, but it's been trending downwards since 2000. And it's also, I did get as much back history as I could, and we can see that the really, I guess, the heyday of the dollar was in the 1960s through the 1970s. And there was a lot of demand for US dollars internationally. Well, the dollar was a lot less popular in the early 1990s, but then it surged again as the I guess it's really the export income that China was getting from the early 1990s, and then that was starting to be recycled, and other countries recycling their foreign currency are trying to hold US dollars. That was one of the primary factors in driving that demand, but it is trending downwards. If there is less foreign demand for dollars, well, then the market for those securities that the US government is selling, well, they're going to have a more difficult time selling them. Now, we've had a meaningful drop in the official holdings or the reserve holdings of treasuries, and it was peaking really back in 2013. And China, since Xi Jinping took power, has been much more independently minded, and they have basically stopped accumulating US treasuries. And we had a meaningful sell-off in that total all the way through 2022. Now it has improved somewhat over the course of the last 6 or 7 months, and this hasn't been updated since the end of May. So there's a significant lag, but the trend downwards does look to be still intact. Now, what I thought was most especially interesting is that if you look at all the holdings of US Treasury securities outstanding that are held by foreigners, not just as sovereigns, but everywhere, it's actually still going up. That's, I think, the primary reason why yields haven't gone even higher than they have now, that there are still buyers for US Treasuries out there, and that this index is still rising. But the total debt outstanding is going up probably a bit faster, and it's up now to 32.65 trillion. And this trend is inexorable. There's nothing to say that it's not just going to continue. This is a log scale chart, too. And if we just look at that on an arithmetic scale, well, we can see then just how big a jump we've had once the debt ceiling was increased. Then the size of issuance has been quite profound. Another trillion has been issued in just the last 10 weeks. So we're certainly in an environment where there's a lot of debt being issued, and this is beginning to raise some of the long-standing questions around debt sustainability. Now, the bigger question, of course, is why, if this is the case, why isn't the dollar rolling over? Well, the dollar isn't rolling over because the Federal Reserve has got a number of different jobs. Now, they have two mandates. One is to try and promote economic growth, and the other one is to try and keep unemployment down. But then they do have another function, which is to create an orderly market for the US government's debt. And when investors don't want to buy it and yields are rising, well, they are going to have to continue to raise interest rates, and in order to create a benign buying environment for treasuries, and that's helping to support the dollar in the short term. So the dollar index is continuing to rally. But I think it's also important to think about, well, what's it rallying against? When we look at the Bloomberg Dollar Index, I think we get a bit more intelligence, because this has a higher weighting for both the renminbi and the rupee. So what's happening in China right now has long-term consequences. The renminbi now is weakening through the 7.2 level, and it's been finding support around the 7.2 level on repeated occasions since 2019. We do need to just put into perspective that this more volatile trading phase is quite new. And prior to that, China isn't alien to a massive devaluation of its currency when the need arises. And we saw that all the way through the 1980s, where they devalued the currency on successive occasions. So the period of time where there has been a relatively strong or at least rangy renminbi is really quite new. And the reality is China needs a weaker currency. They need to try and reignite the economic engine. Well, the two big drivers of growth in China historically have been manufacturing and exports, and then construction. Well, the property sector is really under a cloud. Now, I remain very much of the view that China Vanka is one of the best ways to monitor the outlook for sentiment, and it is still trending lower. And there is the possibility that it will break lower. Now, it's a state-owned company, and it's pretty much royalty when it comes to property developers. So there's no prospect of it going bust. But It can still trend downwards and continue to trend downwards for quite a while yet. You had Country Garden in here today and apologizing for the stress that they have inflicted upon their customers, and the share broke downwards to a new reaction low. And you have to go back and look at it, really a lot of back history before you can find a time when it traded at this level. In fact, it was right in the region of the low back in 2008. So this has been a really quite remarkable change of fortunes for the company. But China has the most expensive property in the world relative to domestic income. And since foreigners aren't allowed to buy properties, what it really means is that a lot of the money that the country is earning from businesses and exports is being recycled into domestic property. And the millions of vacant properties or housing units all over the country, that's really just that's a reflection of the savings of large numbers of people, that there isn't a property tax, so they just buy properties. They don't want to live in them, and they don't do them up either, because by and large, when an apartment building is finished in China, you just get a shell, and the first and second fitting is, and indeed all of the refurbishment or the furnishing the housing unit, that's all the buyer's responsibility. So a lot of these housing units are totally vacant and looked derelict, but they do have windows, they do have doors, and it's unlikely that any of them are really going to be lived in unless prices come down significantly. Now let's put into perspective what's China been doing over the last decade. They're more aware of the reliance that the economy has on infrastructure and housing than any of the rest of us. And if you knew that you needed to bring down the property price relative to income, and you wanted to ensure that that could be achieved without being turfed out of power, without having massive social unrest, well then, if you had total control over the economy, what would we do? Well, the first thing is we would try and create a law-abiding and rules-based economy where people are afraid to transgress. And we would beef up the police force. So China has implemented facial recognition. They have had mass imprisonment of what was considered to be a rebel province in Xinjiang. And then they've created the social credit score. They have massively censored the media, and all of that has been in service to exerting full control. Now that they have control, what they're starting to do is to unwind the property market. And this underperformance of the property developers is not a mistake, it's a plan. Now, what they're trying to do is to manage it lower. And managing it lower is exceptionally difficult. And the obvious risk is that they go through a Minsky moment, and that you get a triple waterfall crash where demand just evaporates, the leverage in the system unwinds all at once, and then you have a banking crisis. That's obviously a risk in China, and we're continuing to see that the stock market is rolling over. But and the banking sector was in negative territory today. The CSI 300 index continues to roll over. And of course, then the counter argument is that China is a manipulated stock market, and you can't really take signals from it as being reliable. So let's then look at copper, because copper is a major component in infrastructure development, and it's not something that they have a lot of domestic supply of. And China has about a 57% weighting in the global copper market, and copper prices are rolling over. We have a Type 2 top formation between 2021 and early 2022. Then we had this massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Period of right-hand extension, and now the price is rolling over again. So this looks like a rather difficult environment. And it suggests that Chinese demand in terms of infrastructure development is not nearly as robust as people might hope. Now, then we also have oil prices. So there was a temptation to think that because oil prices were lower, that it was because Chinese demand was evaporating. Well, if Chinese demand were truly evaporating, then the price would have accelerated lower. That's not happening, and now, in fact, oil prices are breaking higher. What this suggests is that Chinese oil demand remains fairly stable, even if the copper demand is deteriorating. Now, let's also just think about, well, why has oil broken on the upside? It has clearly broken the medium-term downtrend. Well, there's, I think, the primary reason is that the non-OPEC supply has not kept up with investment. So lots of the primary oil majors, they haven't been investing in new supply. They've been worried about the green movement and being accused of raping the planet, and then also having difficulty really getting or I guess they've had to concede seats on the board to more environmentally conscious investors. So that has curtailed their ability to invest. Now, companies like BP and Shell are abandoning some of that right now, and they are starting to do better. Or at least they're starting to invest in new supply. And one thing that we can then think about is, well, if they haven't been investing in supply, who has? And well, then the OPEC big members, Saudi Arabia, for example, they have exceptionally ambitious construction plans. Building a 75-mile long city is one of the plans. The Tadawul all-share index is now finding support in the region of the 200-day moving average. And I think that there is clearly the potential that the Saudi market is being re-rated. This entire range that's been put in over the last 18 months looks like a first step above the base. So we can think about the Saudi Arabia ETF, and it's going to have a very similar trajectory because it is US dollar denominated. But I think that there is very clearly the potential that the Saudi Arabian market is going to do quite a bit better over the course of the next decade because they're reinvesting a lot of money in their own country. One of the primary things that MBS has been saying is that he would rather bring people to Saudi Arabia, bring industries, bring entertainment to Saudi Arabia rather than have Saudi Arabians going overseas to engage in leisure, education, or jobs. Well, that's a good reason why Saudi Arabia is no longer buying US treasuries. They would rather spend the money domestically and try to build up their own domestic economy. But that also suggests that the economy will grow, and they are doing their level best to try and enhance the productive capacity of their very large young population. I think that is one of the things that we're going to see evolve. Because when we look at the world right now, it's difficult because interest rates have gone up a lot, and stock markets have been reasonably benign, and we've really had a very impressive rally over the last 7 or 8 months. And there's obviously the temptation then to think that we are going back to exactly the same kind of environment we had prior to the pandemic. But that is 100% on the assumption that interest rates go back down to zero and stay there. Now, I do think that it is inevitable we're going to have a recession. We have inverted yield curves. And what's happening right now is that the yield curve is re-steepening. So it's contracted now to 74 basis points from greater than 100 basis points only 3 weeks ago. And the long end of the curve is rising faster than the short end of the curve. Now, usually it's that the short end of the curve contracts quickly because interest rates go down. Well, we're not seeing interest rates contract right now. Instead, it's that the long end of the curve is rising faster. And that is more about debt sustainability. Then, obviously, that is going to have a knock-on effect eventually, that you can't have yields marching higher and with impunity, because everything is priced off the 10-year. If you can get 4% from owning 10-year treasuries, then you need to earn 4% in another asset class let's just look at the 12-month and think about how investors are positioning themselves. Because if you want to lock in 5.33%, you can buy a 12-month bond and capture a guaranteed return of 5%. Now, the stock market is up meaningfully this year. So if we look at the NASDAQ, it's up over 30%. The Dow Jones is behaving more like a bond, and it's only up about 6%. But every market in Europe is up about, around the 10 to 20% level, and the Italian index is up 22%. But China is in negative territory for the year on a currency-adjusted basis. We can definitely see that in nominal terms, the CSI 300 is flat, but in currency-adjusted terms, it's down 4.4%. Now, generally speaking, when you have debt issues and eventually there will be a recession, then that's going to take a lump out of the dollar. But for the dollar to go down, then other currencies have to go up. And with the issues that China's having with the renminbi, then that's obviously problematic and they're not going to want to allow their currency to appreciate. So then what currencies are going to appreciate relative to the US dollar and the renminbi? Well, that really suggests that we're moving into an environment which will probably be ex-US and ex-China, and that it is the rest of the world will pick up the baton in terms of currency appreciation and stock market appreciation, but not until we come to the other side of the impending recession. And that would suggest that there's going to be a lot of chop between now and then. But then, of course, we also have I was just thinking today that the refrain from the big picture long-term audio from the early 2000s was that we were in a secular bear market defined as a generational long period of PE ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. And that was basically the beginning of every long-term audio for about a decade. And when I go back and think about, well, what did that look like in practice? Well, we did have a significant PE ratio contraction for the NASDAQ, and PEs came down a lot from the early 2000s. And then a lot of those companies initiated dividends. So that was a big move in terms of the income, because they didn't generally pay dividends at all. And I think if we spin it forward another maybe 10 or 15 years, there will be several of those technology companies will be parts of the S&P 500 dividend aristocrats. So technology companies generally then, they have sufficient margins that allow them to raise dividends just about every year without a lot of difficulty in doing so. But then, of course, we had Wall Street mostly going sideways. It peaked in 2000, and we really didn't get a clear breakout to new highs until 2013. So valuations did improve. Yields did not go up a lot. We certainly didn't have the same kind of jump in yields that we had into the end of the 1970s period. But yields are rising. And when we then think about Well, where have we seen valuation contraction? Where have we seen dividend yields increase? Well, let's just look at the Euro Stoxx Index. The Euro Stoxx Banks Index. It's got a PE of around 6 and it yields 5.6. So we've had a meaningful compression in terms of valuations and rising dividend yields. And then let's also look at the energy sector. At the XLE Spider ETF, we're not going to get the. Well, I'm going to put up the. I will put up the chart first because it's right back in the region of the peak, and this was a meaningful jump higher in here today in response to continued strength in the oil market. But let's then just look at the oil and gas exploration index for the S&P 500, and we have a PE of 9 and a dividend yield of 5.16. So we've had a meaningful process of valuation contraction. And now we're starting to see much greater evidence of a return to demand dominance. Now, the thing that I find particularly interesting right now is that this is eerily similar to what we had in the early 2000s. That we had had this phenomenally large move in the technology sector, and it was banks and energy that really started to move in the early 2000s, just as the growth portion of the market was rolling over. And they were coming off of low valuations back then as well. And of course, the other big sector that surged higher in the early 2000s was the home builders. And the home builders have performed like tech shares over the course of the last 8 or 9 months. Now they're starting to come back down again because that rising yield is going to start to eat into demand for housing, regardless of whether it's new housing or not. So the housing sector is susceptible to a setback when you have yields rising at this kind of pace. And what it suggests is that we are in the late stages of this economic expansion. We have a sharply inverted yield curve. We have a tightening liquidity environment. We have quantitative tightening underway in several countries. And then we're definitely seeing that appetite for risk is beginning to be curtailed, at least for now. And then the mania that we had in the AI sector is starting to be unwound. Now, people are starting to sell Nvidia ahead of its earnings, but they won't be for another couple of weeks. So it'll be one of the companies to report latest. But that was a big downward dynamic in here this week, and it does look likely that it will give up at least half of this big move higher. That could easily take it back down to the 300 handle. The problem is that even though it's really overbought, these options are really quite expensive. I think that there's probably going to be a lot of trading in the 0 day options rather than the longer term ones. Now, the VIX index has not popped on the upside just yet. It was stronger last week and came down a bit in here this week. But we're at pretty depressed levels for a broad environment where stocks are beginning to roll over. Now, if I try to find the 0 day volatility, I'm going to have difficulty. Let me see if I do apologize. I should have put this up before, and I do apologize. I cannot remember how to find it, but 0 day option volatility is something that is going to be a factor in the next bear market. Because it will be used by investors to take out short positions, and there's going to be heavy volume on days where it starts to come down. I think that's certainly something that will be worth considering here. When we then think about, well, if Europe has seen a significant valuation contraction, and the Euro Stoxx index, just the broad European and Eurozone index, is at a PE of 12. And if we look at the whole of Europe index, it's got a PE of about 13. Then let's think about valuations on the TOPIX in Japan. And the TOPIX index has a PE of 14 and yields 2.25. Now, I think it's important to highlight here that we have the Nasdaq, which has been on an absolute tear for the last decade. And now we can think about the TOPIX index, which put in a base formation for nearly 30 years, put in a small first step above the base between 2021 and 2022, and then broke out. Now, we certainly have a short-term overbought condition in the present time, and we could easily have some pause and consolidation. But the reality here is that the Japanese market is exhibiting really quite profound relative strength. And this is against a background where we have a number of other markets rolling over. But of course, this also fits really quite well into the ex-US, ex-China potential evolving bull market. So we could have European and Japanese markets outperforming. I would hesitate to bet that the Taiwanese market is going to move independently of the Nasdaq, and it is starting to roll over. I do think that there's a lot of innovation happening in South Korea, but because it is so closely tied to the technology sector, it's not likely to be one of the primary growth engines. But then let's then think about the Latin American markets. So I have a soft spot for Mexico because I think that it has clear potential to be one of the primary beneficiaries of reshoring away from China and being one of the major manufacturing hubs for North America. Now, the ETF at the moment is pulling back, and it could easily pull back to test the region of the 200-day moving average. Personally, I've been waiting for a deeper pullback to initiate a position. In the face of a US recession, well, then the manufacturing center that benefits from demand in the USA isn't likely to hold out indefinitely. But I do think it will be a buy on the dip. Then let's think about Brazil. I think there are a couple of different points that are worth making about Brazil. The first is that the primary weightings in the market are both Vale and Petrobras. Well, Petrobras has historically been the piggy bank of the political class, and they've been raiding it for income and for lining their own pockets for a long time. And then, of course, you have Vale, and it's totally dependent on Chinese demand for iron ore. And I think that is something that we should be paying attention to, that if Chinese infrastructure development isn't firing, then there is going to be less demand for iron ore. And China has more spare capacity for iron ore, for steel production than most of the rest of the global market. And they produce more steel than the rest of the world combined. Well, if they're not building as many tall buildings and tower blocks, maybe they're going to start putting all that steel into building aircraft carriers, but there's a lot of excess steel that they need to find something to do with. But Vale does look like it is rolling over here, and I'm still of the view that it is the industrial resources are the best way of monitoring the outlook for China, and iron ore prices are rolling over. Now, of course, we've had a significant reorientation of the majors in the industrial resources sector. And BHP is now more focused on the renewable energy metals, and Rio Tinto made a big push towards them almost a decade ago. but BHP is rolling over. It's an exceptionally choppy chart, and this kind of volatility generally means that one sells on rallies and buys on dips, and it does look likely we're going to have another dip in here. And those dips can be quite profound. So I think that it is more likely than not that with the competing forces between ebbing demand in China, or at least the end of demand growth in China, and then the continued drive towards the build out of the zero emissions industries, then we're more likely than not to have a ranging environment overall for the industrial resources. Now, of course, oil prices are a different story because oil is totally, I guess, it's totally essential to every economy, and it is very hard to displace. And then what we really need to see, if we're thinking about the longer term, then on the broad balance of debt and growth, there's the clear potential that the dollar and the renminbi will trend downwards, that alternative markets, which have already gone through a process of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields, will benefit as a result. And that certainly fits into the ex-US, ex-China model. But then there is, of course, the potential for technological innovation. And during the 2000s, we had plenty of technological innovation. Google didn't IPO until 2003. And we had the iPhone released in 2008. Now, of course, it was that release late in the cycle for commodities was really sowing the seeds for the technology-led bull market that was really powered by low interest rates. So it is likely that we're going to have significant technological innovation over the course of the next decade. There will be meaningful innovation in the technology sector through healthcare. It's the sector that is most amenable to big data because there are vast data sets. And just the data in the one person's human genome, then on top of that, all of the data included within the microbiome and the number of neurons in one brain. This is the kind of data that would have been impossible to try and parse only a decade ago. And then we're going to have to see a significant build out, and there will definitely be significant breakthroughs in terms of human health and longevity as a result of what's going on in the biotechnology sector today. Then we're going to have a lot more nuclear reactors built, and this is a very early stage environment, and the profitability of some of these companies is many years out in the future. NuScale Power, for example, IPO'd in late 2020, and now it is well below the IPO price. They don't anticipate having a reactor up and running for at least another 4 or 5 years, so they're still a long way from their first income, and that basically means that it could be quite some time before we see a big move higher in the price. But the pace of innovation continues. And then I think it's small modular reactors will be the innovation that helps to eventually control energy prices in this cycle. We have definitely started to see that there is net positive energy from fusion experiments, and the experiment that proved it was possible in December has been repeated, so it's not a one-off. But just because it is proved possible doesn't mean that it's close to commercialization. The ITER project in the south of France, which has been the most expensive science experiment ever and has been funded by all the major nuclear powers, well, that's not even going to have first ignition until the early 2030s. There's a big race on among private companies to try and get there first. This is very reminiscent of the race that took place to sequence the genome. The Human Genome Project had been pioneered by academics who were lackadaisical and enjoying the checks and not doing a lot of work, and along comes Craig Venter, and the entire project gets done a lot faster. It's a very similar type of situation with the ITER project. There's been a lot of collaboration, but no real urgency. And the innovations that have been developed as part of that project, well, they haven't really been put to use yet. Even the fact that the design that was agreed maybe 20 years ago, well, superconductors have really improved significantly since then. And that's the primary reason that a lot of these startups believe that they can get it done faster and cheaper because it can be smaller. And of course, what I think is really ironic, it was that the tokamak reactor at MIT was shut down, and a lot of these researchers lost their funding. And within 3 months, they were launching new plans. They said they could get it done within a decade, and that they could do it for only a couple of $100 million. And that probably would never have come to fruition. Or the funding at least would never have appeared were it not for them losing their funding in the first place. So we're going to have serious technological innovation. There will be big steps forward in energy. And of course, then the big question, and I think it really is the really or I guess the big question for robotics. It's going to be around batteries. So when we think about the military industrial complex, the first AI powered drone aircraft were flown over the last while. And that seems to be the direction of travel, that AI will find its way into military applications. Then we can think about all those robots that Tesla wants to build, and they don't go very far. They don't last very long. The engineering is fine. The AI is improving, but the power source is the significant limiting factor. Now, there's a lot of money that is being poured into battery technology, but until we have a significantly more energy-dense battery, then a lot of the promise that's contained within the electric vehicles, contained within robotics, the desire to create battery-powered ships, and the desire to have battery-powered planes, that is really extremely limited by battery technology. And battery chemistry is hard. And the promises that we've had around solid-state batteries, they seem to push out the end date every couple of years, because the first talk about solid-state batteries I saw was in 2016, and then they said it'd be ready in 2018, and then 20, and then 22, and well, we're in 23, and it's still not ready. And Japan had hoped to use the Olympics in 2020 as a showcase for their solid-state battery technology, but it's not in the market yet, and it might still be a while longer. Now, when you have debt issues in lots of different countries, and you have not a great deal of willingness to take the kind of measures necessary to get them under control, well, then the easy way to get a debt problem fixed is get someone else to pay for it. And that generally is what happens after a war, that the winner gets to cancel their debts and the losers are saddled with a massive debt deflation. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that at some stage over the course of the next decade or perhaps more, there will be a global war. There will be a hot war between the USA and China. And all of these toys, all of this technological innovation that has been thrown into the armaments sector, then some of those toys are going to get used. And I think something that is happening out there in the world today is that the arsenals of NATO are being expended in Ukraine. And the entire siege of Bakhmut by the Russians was a delaying tactic, and it allowed them to build trenches and mine the 1,000-kilometer frontier. And there is the real possibility that Ukraine's efforts to push through into or to basically split up the Russian defenses might fail. And we could be in for an even longer and more protracted war. But that's seriously bad news for NATO. And there is obviously then the potential that there's going to have to be a very significant rearmament process. Now, if we're thinking about what could help to drive a new commodity bull market, well, then rearmament is a big one because there would have to be a massive infrastructure build and very significant resources poured into putting in the infrastructure and then redundant infrastructure to be able to surge the number of weapons produced. Because I think everyone is very well aware that Russia has more men and weapons than Ukraine. They've been sending out 50 and 60-year-old tanks. Well, if you're using a Javelin missile to destroy a new tank, you need the same Javelin missile to destroy an old one. And they're rapidly expending the available supply of those missiles. And it's a very similar story in many of the areas or the various pieces of armament. That's the primary reason the USA gave cluster bombs to Ukraine, because they were running out of everything else. So when you have one side that has more men, more armaments, more manufacturing capacity, and you have another that is technologically advanced but doesn't have the ability to increase the number of armaments, well, then one had really better hope that the nuclear deterrent works. But as we've seen in Ukraine, the nuclear deterrent is only so good in deterring nuclear war. When you see that there's a belligerent party, then the ultimate weapon can't be used. So it's a very difficult situation that we're in. And I think that the fragility of the global geopolitical environment is only going to get worse the longer the war goes on in Ukraine, because just because the arsenals in NATO are being run down. And there doesn't seem to be a great deal of urgency within Europe to really start to accelerate the rearmament process, but it is totally necessary. And that is something that will basically persist throughout the entire decade, and money will have to be made available for it. Now, that, of course, is going to become political. And it's also going to have a knock-on effect for the debt sustainability of lots of different countries. But I think that there is the real possibility that it is the ex-US, ex-China markets are going to thrive in this environment. And I think with that, I'll leave you for this week, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.